This week saw an epic 1-in-500-year meeting between King and Pope. We are also introduced to a new Japanese prime minister, and a tech company you've never heard of is going to stop you from buying a new car and is causing a major headache for Germany. We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Yesterday, Pope Francis and King Charles prayed together in the Sistine Chapel, the first time a king and pope have prayed together since the English Reformation 500 years ago. And even before that, this wasn't a common event. It's a historic moment in English and Catholic history, and it's one of several stories from the last week or so to do with the throne in Britain and also to do with the Church of England. So we're going to discuss these first with our Anglo-America correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is really a big year for the Roman Catholic Church's attempts to bring other churches back under Rome's authority. I think we've highlighted before that it's actually the 1700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea. So the Roman Catholic Church is doing a big push on church unity. This meeting between King Charles and Pope Leo didn't really have much to do with that particular anniversary, but the fact that it happened this year when there is so much focus on church unity amongst the Roman Catholic world is significant. Like you said, the first time since the Protestant Reformation, since the King of England actually became the head of his own church, the Anglican Church, that this happened. So, like you said, even before that, it wasn't that common, but the fact that it's the first time since the Protestant Reformation is really just huge news because, like I said, in the Middle Ages when this happened, on the rare occasions it did happen, it wasn't necessarily strange for a Catholic king to pray with a Catholic pope. But now you're having King Charles III, who's technically the head of the Anglican Church, praying with the head of the Roman Catholic Church. It's really designed to, it's designed to highlight the unity between these two churches. But as we've pointed out in much of our literature over the years, and actually even in our editor-in-chief pointed out in his Trumpet brief yesterday, this is really like a clash between two thrones. The Pope sits on a throne, and then King Charles sits on another throne and is the head of another church. And for centuries, the Catholic Church has been trying to get control of the Anglican Church. And now the King of England, he's not even really putting up a fight. He's basically working on the same team as the Pope to make that type of unity happen.
Right. And I think this is one of the biggest goals of his reign. Like you look at the way he's talked about this. I think one of the other things you wanted to talk about just a couple of minutes is Prince Andrew. And I think many people will know about the scandals there. But I saw a story that was saying King Charles's biggest concern about the Prince Andrew scandal was that it would overshadow his visit to the Pope. Which, that's your biggest concern with the Prince Andrew scandal? There's a lot to be concerned about there. But it shows, I think, how devoted King Charles was to this visit. This is something that he really wants to do. And I think sees as a highlight of his reign. And I think he's going to come back to this moment again and again in later speeches. And you mentioned these displays of unity. There was so much there that put on a show of unity. And you mentioned the two thrones. I thought it was just really interesting. They gave the king a new chair. I mean, you could almost call it a new throne. They had a chair for him inscribed with the words "Ut unim sint." It's Latin. I'm probably mispronouncing that. "For that they may be one," and it's going to be there in the Basilica of St. Paul outside the wall for whenever King Charles visits in the future and whenever his heirs visit in the future. So they really are seeing this as a long-term, that's it. King Charles and his heirs are going to be coming to Rome for generations now. They also, they both conferred knighthoods on each other. The Pope is now a Grand Knight. He has the Grand Knight Cross of the Order of the Bath. I guess, I don't know whether that makes him Sir Pope Leo or Pope Sir Leo, or presumably popes just don't use the sirs. He gave the king a papal knighthood. Then they gave each other these titles. The Pope gave King Charles the title Royal Confrater of the Abbey of St. Paul. And then the king proclaimed the Pope, papal confrater of St. George's Chapel at Windsor Castle, which confrater, I'd never heard this term before. It's Latin for fellow brother. It's kind of used as an associate of a religious order. But the Catholic Herald talked about how basically this title confrater typically belonged to Catholic monarchs who were kind of given this position as honorary protectors of certain basilicas in the Vatican. So the Pope is declaring King Charles his fellow brother. King Charles is declaring the Pope his fellow brother. He's now giving him a title that they normally give to Catholic monarchs and basically saying, yep, you are a protector of the Catholic Church now. So, okay, like in terms of unity, like they don't have intercommunion. A Catholic can't go and take communion at the Church of England. There are differences. We have a female Archbishop of Canterbury right now. But you look at where these two are going, and I was thinking about, we've got November 5th coming up. Remember the 5th of November, gunpowder, treason, and plot, where this is we have bonfires and fireworks, and it's to commemorate the foiling of Guy Fawkes, a Catholic terrorist who tried to blow up the king and the Houses of Parliament. And until maybe a generation, two generations ago, effigies of the Pope would be burned on bonfires up and down the country. So in the space of maybe a couple of generations, we've gone from we're burning effigies of the Pope to, okay, not full unity, but the king and the Pope hugging, shaking hands, calling each other brothers. Very clearly, they are on the way to unity. And there's a radical change in the way these two churches view each other.
Yeah, and those knightly titles, I feel, are so significant because we talk a lot on this program about how the Pope is really leading up a seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, foretold in Revelation 17 and many other chapters of the Bible. And when you start seeing them confer these papal knighthoods and these knightly titles, to me at least, it really just does emphasize that talking about that seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, that's not just poetic talk or an apt analogy, but they are actually still conferring actual titles of knighthood stretching back to the Holy Roman Empire. So it's the same organization which controlled England for much of the Middle Ages and is seeking to control it again and to bring King Charles and others back into the Catholic fold. Now, we know from some other Bible prophecies in Hosea and Micah and many of the Old Testament prophecies that England won't be peacefully absorbed into that empire. Mr. Armstrong spoke often that England would not be part of the EU based on the fact that there's prophecies about these final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire forcibly conquering England into its empire. So at some point in the future, we are going to have to witness some force from the Holy Roman Empire to finally get England annexed into its growing territory. So it is really just kind of surprising, though, at this stage, to see how easy King Charles is trying to make this. He really seems to be, I'm sure there's probably others in the conservative parties of England who are not as enthusiastic, but King Charles, he really seems to be on the Holy Roman Empire's side at this point.
On that point of others not being as enthusiastic, Kyle Paisley, the son of Ian Paisley, who he got up in the European Parliament and told the Pope he was the whore of Babylon. So not a papal fan. He did say that the king was being untrue to his oath and should abdicate after doing this. So there's some pushback. Not masses, I don't think. It's not really been a big thing of contention. I think it's also true with the female Archbishop of Canterbury. I think we've reached the point in Britain that people don't really care that much about papal affairs. But you know, this on this point about Bible prophecy, I mean, we are seeing fulfilled prophecy in watching this happen. Mr. Armstrong wrote all the way back in the, I think it was in the 50s, the 60s. He said, we're going to see the greatest revolution in religion the world has witnessed. And the Telegraph, describing what has happened this week, said it was the moment that made ecclesiastical history. The king and the pope joined together in prayer, marking the public end to a 500-year-old divide and ushering in the Christian faith into a new era. I mean, it's, yeah, the greatest revolution in religion the world has ever witnessed. We're watching it happen. And his Plain Truth magazine, it said Europe will go Roman Catholic, Protestantism will be absorbed into the Mother Church and totally abolished. We have a whole chapter in our book, He Was Right, that goes through, here are the key scriptures. This is why Mr. Armstrong forecast this. This is all based on Bible prophecy. Those quotes were from the 1960s, actually. But he was saying this even before the Vatican II reforms. This is a dramatic fulfillment of Bible prophecy. And then you have this added element of the king being involved and the way that the royal family isn't just part of the Church of England's shift back to Rome. It's driving the Church of England back to Rome. I think it's playing a leading role in bringing the whole country back to the Roman Catholic Church. It's leading the way. That is another remarkable development. And we have an article from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, Should the King Pray with the Pope, that he wrote this week, where I think we're not going to have time to really get into the meat of this on our weekend review show. But there's a lot of Christians, there's a lot of people out there that would look at this and say, well, this is great. This is churches coming together and it's unity and it's a wonderful thing. But as Mr. Flurry talks about in that article, it might seem noble to some, as he says there. But actually, he says, it's satanic to the core. He says, many Catholics are just as sincere in their religion as anyone else, but this church has a history that should concern us all. Britain in particular should know better. He talks about all of the sacrifice that has gone into maintain Britain independent from this church. And now it's the royal family bringing them back. He says, Anglicans are embracing the bitterest enemy of the British throne. This is a shocking development, considering the history of the Roman Catholic Church in England. And I think, again, this is about deeply held beliefs and very sincere people. So I think really to get to the grips of that, you'd have to read this article, Should the King Pray with the Pope? And to really understand the depths of what's going on here. But as you say, it's two thrones, and it's the British throne leading the nation to Rome. And one of the trends that we've talked about as well in relation to that throne is God holds the people on that throne accountable. They've been given incredible blessings, and God holds them accountable for that. And he's already cursing that throne. And part of that cursing, or part of the reason for that, is the way that they're leading the nation back to Rome. And we saw more on the curses this week with some of the news about Prince Andrew. I think that was something else you wanted to bring up.
Yeah, I definitely think both the Church of England and the royal family have a lot to answer for in as to why the Roman Catholic Church is having so much success bringing Anglicans back into the fold. Because in a lot of ways, you can kind of sympathize with some of the disillusioned Anglicans who they're not really getting much hope or inspiration or vision from either their church or their king. And so are now looking elsewhere, in this case to the Pope. Like you mentioned earlier, the other two big pieces of news from Britain this week are they announced that the next Archbishop of Canterbury is going to be a woman. And there's very plain scriptures in the New Testament dogmatically stating that women aren't to teach in churches. So any Anglican who takes the Bible at face value, or at least is attempting to take the Bible at face value, can see that there's something profoundly unbiblical about that. This decision, it's even created a split in the Anglican Church. But I think that's one of the big reasons many of the Anglicans are looking to an organization to the Roman Catholic Church, which thinking that, like, well, our church is clearly violating some of these very basic biblical principles. Maybe we need to look elsewhere. And then at the same time, you've got this scandal with the king's brother, Prince Andrew, and it's been known for years that he was a friend of the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Epstein's back in the news as politicians in America are trying to tie Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein more closely, and so far they haven't had much success proving that Donald Trump had any relationship with Epstein other than they knew each other. But in Prince Andrew's case, there's definitely a lot more concrete information that he was doing things that were inappropriate. And I think the royal family has kind of at least tacitly admitted that and has now had Prince Andrew come out. And he's actually, at the same time his brother King Charles is getting all these new titles from the Pope, Prince Andrew's had to give up many of his titles. A circumstance that's bringing a lot of shame on the British royal family. One of the royal biographers, Andrew Lowney, he called Prince Andrew's fall from grace possibly the worst crisis in living memory for the British royal family. So he's putting this up as a worse crisis than anything that's happened with Prince Harry or even with anything that happened between Charles and Diana. And so within living memory, and he may well be right about that. I mean, some of these allegations, if they're true, are pretty concerning. So it's definitely casting the British royal family in a very bad light in the eyes of the people. At the same time, this decision to make a female Archbishop of Canterbury is casting the Church of England in a very bad light with anyone who even pretends to believe in the Bible. And so that's got to be two huge catalysts for why you're not seeing more people complain about the king praying with the Pope. I feel like if the Church of England was trying to stick closer to the Bible and the royal family was trying to set a better example, more people would be upset about the king paying homage to the Pope like that. But considering the scandals in the royal family and the scandals in the Church of England, people just, they don't seem upset that the king's praying with the Pope, and some of them might be at least understandably relieved.
I think that's a really good point. I'm actually working on something for our next print edition talking about some of this more broadly, where Mr. Armstrong said for years to watch for the rise of this Catholic Holy Roman Empire, and we've been forecasting the rise of this Catholic Empire, and kind of part of that is the increase of power of the Catholic Church. And yet, for the past several decades, the trend has generally been for the Catholic Church to be, say, less and less relevant, at least in the Western world. You know, it played a massive role in the fall of the Soviet Union and the Iron Curtain falling, and it's got a very strong presence in Latin America and Africa. And you know, I don't want to underplay its power and dominance in the world, but in terms of at least, say, church attendance in Western Europe and America and Britain, it's generally been falling. And now we're in this midst of this religious revival and of a sort, and you've got a lot of people unhappy with woke, unhappy with just, I'd say, the ugliness of popular culture and the new and dangerous and destructive fads that have been coming in, and transgenderism and these new ideas that have proven radically destructive. And a lot of these people have now become convinced, rightly so, that God is the answer and they need to get back to something timeless and traditional. And the Catholic Church looks like the solution, much more so than groups like the Church of England or various different Methodist associations, where, okay, I think for those kind of individuals, maybe women bishops aren't the biggest deal maker, but these are churches that no longer even make any kind of pretense of building their beliefs from the Bible. Bible says women shouldn't teach in church. They say, well, we know better than Paul did. Like, in many ways, it seems false advertising to call themselves Christian churches if they quite plainly disagree with Jesus Christ, who said, live by every word of God. And Peter confirmed that Paul's writings are scripture. So they've departed that. And so it means that all of these churches that generally have women preachers, they also have often embraced homosexuality and transgenderism even, and they have all kinds of weird church services. You had the Anglican, you had the Church of England decorating the cathedral at Canterbury, their kind of headquarters church, their equivalent of St. Peter's Basilica, say, with graffiti. And it looks ugly. And it's completely signed up to the woke movement. And so for these people saying, hey, I want God in my life as an answer to the woke movement, the Catholic Church looks like, and even the Orthodox Church, looks like a pretty appealing solution. And so there have been a lot of Catholic influencers, even Orthodox influencers online, that have been very successful in kind of bringing new converts to the Catholic Church. And you're getting an uptick in converts coming into the Catholic Church. And it's understandable, I think. You can or at least I can understand why people are going there. But this is why I'm so glad we've got our new booklet. Can you prove which church is God's? Because being ancient and having old traditions and even having beautiful buildings and artwork does not make a church God's church. Teaching what Jesus Christ taught, you know, that's what God's church does. Does the Catholic Church do that? Well, you know, it's incumbent upon you. It's incumbent upon every individual to prove that for yourself. Don't take my word for it. And so that book, Can You Prove Which Church Is God, will help answer that and help you prove, where is God's church? Is it the Catholic Church? I mean, it doesn't address that directly, but it addresses this question more generally and helps you see, okay, well, what do I need to do? What do I need to look for to find God's church, to prove that the Catholic Church is God's church? But I think that's a good point you make there about, well, all of this is a big part of the reason why nobody is concerned about Pope Leo and the King meeting. And in fact, some of the most conservative Church of England members that previously would have been the most staunch opponents of the Pope getting more involved in English and Church of England affairs, they're probably the ones that are most aghast at women bishops and at all of these different things that they're getting into. Maybe some of them are relieved. But anyway, I think you had some other stories as well to give us a rundown of from the English-speaking world.
In the United States, we passed another national debt milestone, moving past the $38 trillion mark. And at this point, the national debt, I mean, it's going up constantly. But I do at least try to give an update in the other news on this program every time it passes another trillion mile marker. So it just passed $38 trillion, well above the size of the U.S. economy, which is only about $30 trillion. So our debt to GDP ratio is up well above 100%. And moving closer and closer towards, I think up probably about 125%, moving closer and closer towards bankruptcy. There's quite a bit of debate over exactly what debt to GDP ratio you have to get before your economy completely collapses. I think current consensus is hovering somewhere around 200%. So if we're at 125%, at the rate of spending, it won't be long before we hit that 200%. So that's definitely something to be very concerned about here in American news. Couple other concerning stories from the United States. One that is actually kind of some positive news about a negative trend is President Trump is flying U.S. Air Force planes closer and closer to Venezuela. He's really trying to crack down on the drug trade, which is a positive development, and deliberately sending planes not into Venezuelan airspace, but right next to Venezuelan airspace, just to send a signal to the Venezuelan government, which is very involved in the drug cartel trade, the Cartel of the Suns, is a very influential cartel run directly by the Venezuelan government, that America could be willing in the near future to take actual military action against Venezuela or cartels in other nations in order to try to just get this drug cartel trade, which is destroying America, under control. I actually believe for several years now, the leading cause of death in the United States among those under age 54 is drug overdose. So over age 54, the leading cause of death is old age. So, but next to old age, the leading cause of death is drug overdose. So serious problem here in the United States that President Trump's trying to get a handle on in a way that if things get worse could actually lead to more military conflicts between America and some of its southern neighbors. And then finally, we were talking about public opinion sea changes earlier about just how Britons view the Catholic Church. There's also a public opinion sea change going on about how Americans view the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. For years, Israel's been able to look at the United States as kind of its strongest friend. While the Europeans tend to favor the Palestinians, America's always kind of had Israel's back. And now, I believe for the first time ever, a Reuters IPOS poll released on Wednesday showed that 60% of Americans support the recognition of a Palestinian state. That's still something the Trump administration opposes. America has not officially recognized a Palestinian state. The Trump administration has no plans to recognize a Palestinian state and has condemned nations like France for doing so. But at least according to this poll, it looks like for the first time they've been taking these polls, a majority of the American people, about 60%, would be in favor of doing that, which is just a huge public opinion change if that poll is accurate.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Well, Japan got a new prime minister this week, and we also got a bit of a look at what her top priorities are going to be. To learn more about her and where Japan is going, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. Japan elected its first female prime minister this week. This is a hardline conservative woman named Sane Takaichi, and she's a real China hawk, very concerned by the Chinese Communist Party's exploitative trade practices and its growing military belligerence, particularly in Japanese waters. And she wants Japan to become more militarily capable and assertive in order to face those threats. She's also expressed concerns about rising belligerence from North Korea and Russia as well. And so she wants military spending in Japan to hit 2% of the nation's gross domestic product, and she wants that to happen by March. So that's really speeding up the previous timetable for that. And it shows that she is very serious about building up Japan's military power. And while Mrs. Takaichi says Japan's alliance with America is essential to Japanese security, she also wants the Japanese military to take on a larger and more autonomous role in defending itself. And toward that end, she is an outspoken advocate of revising Japan's pacifist constitution. So that's a major move that would really free Japan to fully normalize its military and to expand it even beyond its already stunning power. But we don't know how much of this she'll be able to really make happen. She actually won only 237 out of 465 votes cast in the lower house of the legislature. That poor performance followed her Liberal Democratic Party's recent disastrous losses in both houses. And it meant that her government was only formed thanks to a very uneasy last-minute coalition that she built with the Japan Innovation Party. And so that's an alliance, a coalition that analysts do not expect to last. So she's got some serious obstacles to overcome. But in either case, really, whether or not Takaichi's fragile alliance ends up lasting long enough for her to accomplish these very hawkish goals, we should expect Japan to continue its march toward remilitarization and military normalization. And we should expect it to keep on pushing for more independence from the United States.
So that's one significant development from Asia. I think another thing a lot of people are talking about now is the new sanctions that President Trump has put on two of Russia's biggest energy companies, where it's been kind of a bit of a big dramatic week swinging backwards and forwards for President Trump's policy on Ukraine and Russia. We're heading for a big meeting in Hungary between Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin. That's now called off, and instead we're looking at sanctions. So, I mean, how significant are these sanctions? What's involved? Where is this taking us?
Yes, that's right. That big meeting that had been scheduled between Presidents Trump and Putin, it was called off after Putin refused to accept Mr. Trump's plan to essentially freeze the fighting along the current front lines. And then, as you said, just yesterday, President Trump followed that up by levying some pretty serious sanctions on two of Russia's top oil companies. So that's Rosneft and Lukoil. These sanctions are designed to basically dry up Putin's funding for the war and to muscle him back to the negotiating table. And it does look like they could have some effects, at least on the funding part of that. And that's largely because there is a secondary mechanism that's built into these sanctions. You could call it secondary sanctions. And it means that any company in the world that does business with these two Russian companies will be blocked from U.S. capital markets. So this mostly affects China and India. Those are the two nations that have been buying great quantities of Russian oil throughout the war. And those purchases are a huge part of what has enabled President Putin to continue to pay his soldiers, to continue to manufacture new weapons and procure weaponry from other nations as well. But now, the Chinese and the Indians have to essentially choose between either ending those purchases of Russian oil or losing access to dollar funding and the wider Western financial system. And so far, it does look like the Chinese and the Indians are at least making an appearance of backing away from Russia. On Thursday, China's state oil majors suspended their purchases of Russian seaborne oil. And Indian refiners also moved to slash their Russian oil imports. So it does look somewhat promising, at least on paper, but we've seen China and India and even Europe find creative ways to circumvent these kinds of sanctions throughout this war. And I think that we'll see a lot more of that in the months ahead. And then it's also relevant that China buys a great deal of its oil from Russia through pipelines. So those shipments are much harder for the U.S. to track than seaborne shipments. So I don't think we'll see the pipeline deliveries interrupted at all. And then it's also relevant that Vladimir Putin has transformed Russia's economy into a war economy now. So that gives it some durability and some resilience, at least in the medium term, that defy a lot of normal economic pressure. So we'll see what happens there. But whatever does happen, President Putin, he's shown that he's willing to weather the pressure. His determination to prosecute the war is unwavering, you know, despite whatever costs he has to make the Russians pay. And he has proven himself very effective at convincing his people to bear down more and more and to sacrifice more of their sons and to endure ever leaner times. You know, he always portrays that sort of thing as a noble sacrifice that the Russian people need to make in service to a righteous war. That's the way he frames it and the way his propagandists spin it. And it does seem to land with the Russian people. Now, there would come a time eventually when, no matter how it was spun, the Russian economy would begin to buckle. But that doesn't appear to be imminent right now. And it would require, I think, just a great deal of resolve and unity from America and Europe that so far in this war have been in very short supply. And President Trump actually has already come out and said that he's very anxious to lift these sanctions from Russia. So we'll see what happens. But whatever the near-term outcomes are, we should expect Putin to be unbroken by these sanctions or anything else. We have a booklet called The Prophesied Prince of Russia by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. It goes through all these prophecies about Russia in the end time and specific passages about the man who will be at its helm when it wages some very momentous wars still ahead. And Mr. Fleury says that these passages are about Vladimir Putin. So that would mean he's not going anywhere, sanctions or not. And his most consequential wars are still ahead. And if anyone would like to understand those passages about Putin and see what to expect from him and from Russia in the years ahead, that booklet once again is called The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
So just on one of those points here, the secondary sanctions, do you know if they're for sure America's going to be doing secondary sanctions? So that's sanctions on any company that trades with Lukoil, or I think from what I read, it was a possibility that Donald Trump's executive order gives, I think it's Stephen Miller, the ability to place those, but that's not automatic. Do you know if then it's been decided that those will go ahead?
Well, see, those secondary sanctions are really what gives this whole sanctions package teeth. Without those, it's essentially what has long been on Russia, though more formally with these. So you're exactly right. I think it remains to be seen to what degree the Trump administration has the resolve to apply those on China, on India, while we're, you know, simultaneously in trade negotiations with both of these major economies. And so I think that there's a lot of guesswork here, and there's a lot of wiggle room for Russia and for the Chinese and the Indians to exploit. So we'll have to wait and see what sort of resolve there is here and if they're actually applied. But the mechanism is in place to punish any company in any nation outside of Russia if they decide to do business with these two Russian firms.
While this talk of trade, sanctions, even growing trade war does bring us nicely to what I wanted to talk about from Europe this week. But before we get there, I think you had one other trade-related story to bring to us.
That's right. Just a very short one here about China overtaking the United States to become Germany's number one trade partner. This was reported on Wednesday, and the data shows that China is now doing more than $1 billion more trade with Germany than the U.S. each year. So that makes it Germany's number one trade partner. And Bible prophecy says that China and Germany will soon lead a worldwide trade alliance that targets the U.S. specifically and blocks America out of a lot of trade. So this is very significant to see China and Germany already becoming so economically reliant on each other.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Now, we really are moving into a world of trade wars. The United States putting sanctions on Russian oil companies. But also this week, we've had a tech company that you have probably never heard of. I thought I was fairly up on my tech companies, even relatively obscure ones. I hadn't really heard of this one until the last month or so. That's really blown up and could stop you from buying a new car, if you are lucky enough to be in the position for shopping for a new car. It's something that is causing crisis meetings in Germany and really with manufacturers and car companies around the world, and that is Nexperia. Nexperia is a Dutch-based company. It makes computer chips. It's owned by the Chinese company Wingtech, and egged on by the US, Dutch authorities seized control of the company on September 30th. They're doing this to try and stop China getting a hold of advanced semiconductor technology and to, in theory, keep it under European control. But Nexperia, okay, they may be Dutch-based, but most of their manufacturing occurs in China. And so China responded by blocking the export of most of Nexperia's chips. Euro Intelligence wrote this week that this has triggered a major supply chain crisis in Europe, potentially on the scale as last seen during the pandemic. There was an Austrian-based company that did some studies. It said that Nexperia chips are used by all of Europe's leading aviation and defense companies, in 95% of leading European mechanical industry companies, 86% of Europe's top medical tech firms, and in 49% of Europe's automotive business. And German car manufacturers could be forced to shut down in as soon as 10 to 20 days, Germany's tabloid Bild reported this week. US manufacturers are expected to run out of chips next month, And this is kind of the specialized function of these chips. They're not being used in your laptop or your iPhone, but they are being used in the advanced electronics of cars. And as a lot of our equipment has become smart and more sophisticated, they don't get these chips. They can't roll them off the production line. You're also seeing China restricting the sale of rare earth magnets. That's used, well, very heavily in electric vehicles and in their electric motors. But just think about the motors that you have in a more standard car, things like the windscreen wipers. And, you know, more advanced cars, you might have automatic electric motors to adjust the wing mirrors or to fold the wing mirrors in and all of these different things. So I think once again, we're seeing the fragility of modern supply chains. So many events just kind of blow up from nowhere to cause all of these problems in places you'd never really think. You know, the pandemic, obviously, we had that ship that blocked the Suez Canal and got stuck there and caused headaches for people all around the world. Now it's some tech company that you've never heard of causing all of these problems. We had AWS. It's a little bit of a different story, but Amazon Web Services go down this week. They had a rare problem, and this affected all of these different websites that could no longer function. We really do live in a very interconnected world, and it doesn't take much to cause pretty significant problems for all these kind of countries. I think it also shows the danger of selling out to China. Nexperia, they had been part of a different Dutch company, NXP, until 2017, and then NXP carved off a chunk of themselves, basically, and sold it off to Chinese investors. And for years, we've been told, oh, that's not a big deal. Like, okay, yeah, the Chinese may own it on paper and they get the profits, but it's still a Dutch company. It's still based in the Netherlands. If push comes to shove, we can take it over. They took it over, but all of all the manufacturing is happening in China. There's still, there's not much that they can do there. But then also, this is causing Europe to think very carefully about its role in the world and where it sides with in the different trade wars going on. I mean, you've got a trade war between America and Russia. You've got trade war basically going on between America and China. Where does Europe stand in that? What side do they want to be in? Their industry is being caught in the crossfire. Not just in this. America is importing less and less from China. China is still making all this stuff, making it very cheaply. They want to sell it in places, so they're selling it in Europe. And this massive influx of Chinese, of much cheaper Chinese electric cars. Well, that's a big crisis for Europe's vehicle manufacturers who are trying to pivot into electric car manufacturer as well. They can't compete with what's coming in from China. So European leaders are wondering, well, are we going to be better off siding with China? As we just heard from Jeremiah, they're now Germany's number one trade partner. Now, they also know that this kind of realignment, breaking with America, siding with China on trade, that's not something that just affects trade. And that's not easy. The US bankrolls Europe's defense. So for Europe to go and to switch, they need to also build their own defense capabilities so that they can aggressively side with China. America's not going to keep paying that bill if America is fighting with China and against America in a trade war. So they've got to build that up. But what we're seeing ties into all of these Bible prophecies, like this shift and this advent of trade war, and then Europe and China actually coming together to besiege the United States. That is prophesied. Mr. Flurry wrote about this in his book, Isaiah's End Time Vision. He said this is where China and the Asian giants enter the picture. He said that considering that China has come to possess most of the world's strategic sea gates, which ironically at one time were held by Britain and America, we believe there may be a brief alliance between the German-led Holy Roman Empire and certain Asian powers, Russia, China, Japan, the kings of the East. Should Europe, the resurrected Holy Roman Empire, find a way to take advantage, even for a moment, of key resources and strategic holdings of China, Russia, and Japan, it would have more than enough power to besiege the Anglo-Saxon nations and enslave them. And that's really where this is leading. All of this trade war, we're going to see Europe very publicly turn against the United States, and we're going to see them siding with China and these Asian giants. And we have a trends article that will give you more about that. It is called Why the Trumpet Watches, the Development of a Massive Anti-American Trade Bloc. You can get that on and read that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can also get that book, Isaiah's End Time Vision. There's a lot more in there than trade relations. I mean, that book really is a look at the wonderful world tomorrow, the soon coming kingdom of God ruling over the earth, what that's going to look like and the time beyond the time of turmoil that is coming up. You can order that. You can get your own free print copy on our website, thetrumpet.com. Well, just to run down some other significant stories from Europe this week. One of the stories we've been covering again and again on these Friday shows has been the political chaos in France, where they've gone through now, where are we? Are we at about 7 prime ministers in under 3 years? It's something like that. The previous prime minister, Lecanu, he became the shortest lived prime minister in history, only to then be to resign and then be reappointed. And he's trying to get a budget through. And I think the finance committee just voted that down. But thanks to a poll published by Le Monde this week, we got a good look at what all of this chaos and this turnover of prime ministers, what that is doing to the country. There's a massive dissatisfaction with politics and even with democracy itself. That dissatisfaction with democracy is most notable among those under the age of 35, where 42% said that another system would be at least as good as democracy. You know, maybe we should experiment with having a dictatorship because this democracy thing isn't working out for us. 96%, according to this survey of 3,000 respondents, said that they were dissatisfied or angry about the state of the country. 85% said that France needs a real leader to restore order. And this is the rise of this strongman politics. 81% say democracy is not working for them. 90% say they believe the country is in decline. 66% that most politicians are corrupt. 63% that they don't feel at home in their country. And Le Monde called these symptoms of France's democratic crisis. I mean, it really is. But we're watching for a democratic crisis across Europe that is going to lead to Europe to submit to a strong German leader. And again, we have our free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, on that. Part of the pressure on Germany to kind of dominate more again, more over Europe, came from Poland this week, where a Polish court refused Germany's request to extradite a Ukrainian diving instructor accused of sabotaging Germany's Nord Stream pipelines. So Germany had these natural gas pipelines connecting them with Russia. They were mysteriously blown up towards the beginning of the latest stage of the Ukraine war, September 2022. And now German authorities have said, well, there's these Ukrainian individuals that are to blame. They've put out European arrest warrants for them. Poland arrested one of these under this European arrest warrant. But this judge said, no, we're not extraditing him. He argued, well, Ukraine is at war with Russia. So for a Ukrainian to attack this Russian infrastructure, that's not a crime. That's simply an act of war. He also said the German nation was, from our point of view, hostile towards Ukraine as it was co-financing the enemy, Russia. So you could argue that this was German infrastructure. But he said, well, nope, it's still fine to attack German infrastructure because Germany was effectively an enemy of Ukraine. I think it's, you know, we've said that all along, that Germany has been on the opposite side to Ukraine quietly. This Polish judge sees exactly the same thing there. But it... that's a pretty big milestone for to have a supposedly European Union ally saying, well, yeah, it's fine to attack German infrastructure. Donald Tusk, he's normally a pro-German prime minister, but he said the problem was not that Nord Stream 2 was blown up, but the fact that it was built. The only people who should be ashamed and should stay silent on Nord Stream 2 are the people who made the decision to build it. And I mean, I am kind of with the polls here. The Nord Stream pipeline was a horrific thing to do. It was clear evidence that Germany had gone behind the backs of its European allies, of its American ally. It was a betrayal of the NATO alliance with its relationship with America. Donald Trump called them out on it several times, very notably. You know, it struck a deal that weakened NATO, even destroyed NATO or greatly threatened NATO. It was a catastrophe for Poland, or maybe catastrophe takes it too far, but a very bad situation for them. The Poles referred to it as the Nord Stream 2 pipeline as the Molotov-Ribbentrop 2 pipeline, in reference to the deal between Hitler and Stalin that divided their country between the two of them. So, yeah, you can definitely understand why Poland is not extraditing this guy. I think it's making Germans also wonder and question, was Poland involved in this attack? Were they complicit? Did they help attack us? If they're trying to cover this up and not trying to extradite people. But then also you had the American conservative make the point that, well, if you do follow the Polish court's logic, you can justify all kinds of attacks on Germany. And the title of that article was Germany Must Rearm. That states the logic of power and empire dictates you cannot be a vegetarian predator. It says that Germany, the economic and manufacturing powerhouse of Europe, is surrounded by small protectorates with blood animosity over distant past historic sins, who simultaneously are egging Germany on to rearm, spend and protect them, while harboring fugitives who destroy German sovereign wealth. This is clearly unsustainable. Germany must rearm. And yeah, it must. It is part way, a lot of the way, towards building an empire. And it financially and politically dominates countries like Poland that, for very justifiable reasons, have a lot of bad blood and no particular love for Germany. And if Germany is going to sustain that dominance the way that Germany wants to, it's going to need force to do it sooner or later. And that's exactly the point that the American conservative is making. And Germany is rearming at a dramatic pace. So watch for them to continue to do that. Mr. Flurry talked about this in a very recent Trumpet print edition. Germany is arming for World War III is the article that's got a lot more about this massive, rapid rearming. He said, Germany's great industrial power is being rapidly transformed for military purposes. Germany is already Europe's largest military spender, but it is only the beginning of a frightening military transformation. So this rise of Germany is a very important prophetic trend, and it's only going to continue. It's only going to accelerate. And that article, Germany is arming for World War III, will take you through much more of the prophecy there. Then just a very quick rundown of some of the other stories. We had so much from Europe this week. Austria, France, and the Netherlands are demanding more censorship from the European Union. They want the EU to do more on so-called hate crimes. The EU is already doing a lot, but I think this reveals the personality, the character of this rising European power. They do not like free speech. You saw several stories about the German military this week on this rise of a strong Germany. So Germany is going to purchase 15 more F-35 stealth fighters, Spiegel reported this week. And these are stealth bombers that can drop nuclear bombs, and America's given Germany the nuclear bombs to go on them. That's a massive level of trust in Germany. So keep watching that story. That gives them a whole lot of power. Germany and the Netherlands are buying 222 infantry vehicles in a $4 billion deal that includes Rheinmetall as a major stake in that deal. Their share price has shot up some more, you know, yet again as a result of that deal. Germany is buying anti-tank missiles from Israel, part of this growing relationship with Israel. Another very important part of that relationship with Israel is that Germany is going to send some soldiers to Israel as part of the peace deal that Mihailo talked about on our Wednesday show. You've got two German staff officers, a brigadier general. They're going to be part of the 200 soldiers monitoring the Gaza ceasefire. I don't believe they will be deployed or be armed. I think that's to get around some of the German restrictions on where their troops can go. But you know, we wrote before when European border guards came to the Rafah border crossing back in February that it was a small beginning of an earth-shaking prophecy. That's really what it is. We are watching for this German military power then to move into the Middle East and to start doing that as a peacekeeper. So it's very, very notable to see a couple of soldiers arriving there. So, and so much news that is right in line with Bible prophecy happening this week. So much fulfilled prophecy this week, right before your eyes. And we're seeing really the fall of Britain and America, the decline of Britain and America, the rise of Europe, the rise of Asian powers. And you know, I'm mentioning a few different pieces of literature, but to get the whole overview, the United States and Britain and Prophecy, a fantastic book to go and get to put all of this into the important prophetic context. That's a more beefy book. Fantastic introduction to Bible prophecy, to understanding, well, where is the United States? Where is Germany in the Bible? It contains the missing key to understand Bible prophecy, and you can get that for free. I'm not trying to sell you anything. We just want to get this out to the largest audience possible. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. But of course, the Middle East and even the divide between Israel and America, that's an important part of all of these prophecies as well. So to get an update of what's going on there, we'll go finally to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, big news in Israel this week. On October 22nd, the Knesset voted on a preliminary bill to annex all of the West Bank. We've talked before in this program how they threatened to take some or part of it where there's mostly Israeli settlers, but the Knesset green-lighted preliminarily to take the whole thing. So what happened with that? Well, the Knesset voted 25 to 24, basically giving, meaning only 49 out of the 120 member Knesset actually even bothered to show up to vote. Most of the politicians in there, including all but one of Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party, boycotted the vote. So this is very much a minority opinion. It was billed by Avigdor Lieberman, a right-wing opposition figure and perennial gadfly to Prime Minister Netanyahu. Mr. Netanyahu reportedly wanted the vote postponed, but Mr. Lieberman went ahead with the vote. What exactly does this mean? Does this mean actually that the West Bank is fully integrated into Israel? Well, it still has to go through a committee review process and then a final secondary vote by the whole Knesset, which could take months. And given the fact that most of the Knesset didn't even bother to vote for this, I think shows you what would happen if they thought that this bill had any chance of getting passed. So probably not going to pass, but at the same time shows a growing appetite within the Israeli government to make a move like this. And they wouldn't be doing so if they didn't think that they'd have some a decent amount of support, at least among the Israeli people as well. Now, this is Israel took over the West Bank in 1967, and they haven't annexed it to this point. There's a lot of reasons for that, mainly because the rest of the world would have a something to say about that. When Mr. Netanyahu previously threatened to do this, this was in response to France and Britain and other countries recognizing a Palestinian state. The United Arab Emirates recently made peace negotiations or a peace deal with Israel. Today, probably its closest ally in the Arab world, they basically said, if you want to do this, the Abraham Accords are history. And that apparently was the big thing that got Mr. Netanyahu to back down from that option. And it's probably a big calculus in his thinking on why he tried to tell all these right-wing groups to not go ahead with the vote, at least now. But there's bigger fish to fry than just the Emirates. The United States weighed in almost immediately after the vote happened. Well, actually, Vice President James Vance was visiting Israel at the time to monitor the ceasefire that his government helped put in. And he said he called the vote a, quote, insult to him for it to happen while he was visiting in Israel, which also implies that he and the rest of the Donald Trump administration make it very clear where their position is and that all these political groups in Israel know that. President Trump himself, in an interview with Time magazine released just yesterday, said this about the plan to annex the West Bank, quote, "It won't happen because I gave my word to Arab countries. Israel will lose all of its support from the United States if that happened," end quote. Which I think is interesting because to this point, he has vacillated quite a bit on where he stands on this. I think he's been using Israel and the right-wing elements there as a bit of a carrot and stick for some of these Arab countries that in Iran. If you don't play ball, we're going to let Israel do whatever they want. But I think this is more of a candid admission that, yeah, I'm not supporting this in any way, shape, or form, and Israel should know it. And if they do go ahead with this, then you're basically getting cut off from your primary ally helping you fight all your wars. And considering President Trump is often called the most ironclad president to be supportive of Israel, and he has done a lot to earn that moniker, and Prime Minister Netanyahu likes to play up his relations with the president, it definitely shows that there are limits to where that partnership will go. And President Trump is not afraid to turn the screws to make sure Israel doesn't go in a direction he doesn't want it to go.
So this unity between Israel and Donald Trump, relative unity, I guess, compared to Joe Biden, and that has been a major source of strength to Israel. And you see where the two were working together, say, on Iran, with the 12-day war there, they did achieve some amazing things. Now, they could have been more ambitious and achieved more, and I think we can regret that that they didn't do, that they went further than simply wounding Iran and kind of finished the job. But still, there's no denying that together they do a lot. This divide then is dangerous. And this is another important prophetic trend.
Yes, as a prophecy we go to here semi-frequently on this program, Isaiah 9:21, that speaks of Judah, the ancestral peoples are of the modern Jews. They still have the name. And Ephraim and Manasseh, two tribes of Israel that form their own nations, which are the United States and Britain today, United States being a Manasseh. That book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that you brought up, that covers that in detail. But it says that those three would be against each other simultaneously, that Manasseh, Ephraim, and Judah would all be tearing at each other's throats. And we saw a lot of that when Joe Biden was in the White House, when Barack Obama was in the White House. A lot of people were thinking that President Trump will mean a different tune. And again, like you said, he has done a lot to alleviate some of the pressure that was before. And it's also important, I think, to distinguish that this isn't, again, Netanyahu's like pet project that he's going full steam ahead and that's a rift with him. This is controversial annexation within Israel itself. And President Trump hasn't necessarily split with Netanyahu over this. But it still shows that even if you have a minority action by a handful of Knesset members doing something that probably will never happen, it still is enough to throw the alliance like almost like out of the water. Maybe that's a bit extreme, but still to cause major tension and disruption for something that ordinarily would not be the case.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's like, I don't think either of us are here saying, right, this is it. Netanyahu and Trump from here on out, they're going in opposite directions and they're going to hate each other. I don't think that at all. And I think we could very well see the two of them come together in things like the 12-day war and more actions. And like, that's still there. But I think you're starting to see an accumulation of stories of friction between the two. And you can definitely see the seeds for a divide. And you can definitely see, you know, events moving in this direction. And maybe it won't happen while Netanyahu is in charge. Who knows the political future exactly? We don't know, you know, in terms of leaders and things like that, what's coming to Israel. But you can see that these two do have different directions, different resources. And even under the MAGA movement, you could see America completely breaking with Israel. And that, as well as the decline of Israel, is then going to, the decline of America is going to pave the way for this European power, this Catholic Holy Roman Empire, stepping in there and saying, hey, we're also very concerned about what happens in Jerusalem. We'll help you keep it safe. And they're going to get welcomed in with open arms as peacekeepers. And again, we're seeing some of the early stages of that happen with European peacekeepers and Europe's involvement even in this Gaza peace accord and some of Europeans' partners and the involvement Europe has in Arab nations that are working as part of this peace accord. So more Bible prophecy that we're kind of watching, and I mean, there's more to watch, but that we're watching fulfilled.
With Israel's situation specifically, it's a small country, it has a small population, very, very skilled technologically with new innovations, especially in the military, as you mentioned earlier with Germany, but they have no manufacturing output. And they have a decent economy, but not like the kind that can sustain the wars they're constantly involved in. From a purely physical perspective, Israel sees it needs a big power behind it to basically stay afloat. And again, President Trump has done a lot to help Israel. But again, if this is the best that Israel can expect, like ever, and there's still so many strings attached and there's still so much mercurialism with President Trump, then Prime Minister Netanyahu and probably plenty of other people with him are probably thinking, we can't continue with this flip-flopping. We need to find another source that's going to be a lot more reliable and not going to constantly change its tune every opportunity it gets. And like you said, that's going to lead Israel to Europe. If I could recommend one piece of literature that will help elaborate that best, that'll probably be the booklet Jerusalem Prophecy by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury, that goes into detail about specifically the modern state of Israel and the problems it's facing today, where all that plays into Bible prophecy and how it involves other nations. And one other thing I could recommend is, obviously, the question of annexation is very controversial. Again, even within Israel itself, there's a lot of people that don't support it. Perhaps longtime viewers can notice we take a little bit more of a less than immediately negative view of that. And if you're wondering why about that, there's an article we had in our print edition in January last year called "Who Has the Historic Right to the Holy Land?" that goes into that a little bit more detail that could hopefully clear up some questions.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. And if you want more on what's been going on in the Middle East, we also got an update on what's been going on there over our time off and a more detailed look at the ceasefire on our Wednesday show. We had to take that down, I think, due to a copyright strike, but it's back up there now with some of the offending B-roll footage removed. You can get that on YouTube or Rumble or wherever it is you get your podcasts. So thank you very much, Mihailo. And I'll just leave you with one recommendation again, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that free book. I think this is a week in review show. We don't have time to get into things in too much depth, but really what we want to do is show you how every week your Bible is coming to life, how every week the events of the week testify to the Bible's authority, to God's power, that all of these different events that can seem chaotic and confusing and even depressing are all happening in the context of God's plan for mankind. And even though a lot of these events are very negative, they have a wonderful, wonderful outcome. And so we will point you to specifics where you can dig more into these different bits of Bible prophecy. And then our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, is a great place to start and get the overview on how, and that's really what we're showing you, how all of these different events tie into God's overview, God's plan, what he is doing with this phase right now on the earth. And so you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. Well, thank you very much as well to all of our panelists, to George Haddad and Victor Granados and Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. We really appreciate all of their help. Thank you to you, the listener. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'll be back on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.